Today's show is sponsored by Cufflinks.com. Of course, Cufflinks.com/DVR. Head on over. As you know, we're leading up to Marvel Avengers Endgame. Use code ENDGAME30 to get 30% off Marvel goodness at Cufflinks.com. They've got so many cool things over there. You got to check it out. And you know what? All the time, you can use code DVR20 to get 20% off your order, no minimum. So use both those codes, but you only got a certain amount of time for Marvel Endgame. That's until the movie comes out. So go to cufflinks.com/DVR and use code Marvel Endgame 30. Now on to the show. Welcome back to Podcast Winterfell. This is Axel. You can find us at dvrpodcast.com. And we've got a very special guest today, a man you may have seen him on his own YouTube shows, or maybe History of Westeros. And his name is LML. Lucifer means Lightbringer. What's up, buddy?
What's going on, Axel? Thanks for having me on, buddy.
I am very excited, I have to say. Now, you are, to me, probably the most interesting man in the fandom at this point. You've got the crown, because I first came to notice you watching some of the History of Westeros live streams, and I would always notice, like, you have like costumes and backgrounds, and even like the words you use is theatrical and just entertaining. So I just started listening, and I have to admit, as a TV show guy, kind of a book guy, I have to kind of research some of the things you say and the way you talk about mythical astronomy. So can you give me an introduction to who you are and what mythical astronomy is and how you see this world of ice and fire?
Cool. Well, first of all, thanks for the very kind words. I don't always drink vitamin water, but when I do, it's on live streams on YouTube. So mythical astronomy is a term that I coined. I don't think anyone else has used that expression before. And I came up with it after just trying to follow along what George is doing. So I think the easiest way to explain it is to relate the basic little nut of my theory. And then you can sort of see why I call it that. So in the second book, or in the first book, Game of Thrones, We hear a legend, and it's in the show too. In fact, the show does a great job of dramatizing this. It's in, like, I think the second or third episode, and Dany is in the tent. Khal Drogo's not there. She's there with her handmaidens, and one of her hand. They're talking about dragons. And they're like, "Oh, dragons are all dead, Khaleesi. Brave men came and kill them, and all this." And she's like, "Well, I heard maybe, you know, they're alive somewhere in the east." And then one of the handmaidens, Daria, says, "Well, one day a trader in Karth told me that there was once a second moon in the sky, and one day it wandered too close to the sun, cracked from the heat, and 1,000,000 dragons poured forth. And that is why, and the dragons drank the fire of the sun, and that's why dragons breathe flame." And the other two handmaidens laugh at her, and they're like, "Ah, silly strawhead slave," because she's blonde, so strawhead is like a racial slur, I guess. And they laugh at her, and nothing more is said of it. And Danny's thinking about the dragons and stuff. But basically, that story is interesting to me because I'm into mythology, and in particular, the idea of people using symbolism and myth to depict the movement of the stars and the heavenly bodies. And so when we've got this thing about, well, a moon wandered too close to the sun, that sounds kind of like an eclipse potentially. And then you have dragons coming from the moon. Well, one day it dawned on me that if there was some sort of celestial catastrophe, what you'd get would be pieces of rock falling from the sky. You'd get meteors. If there was some sort of a moon catastrophe or a moon disaster, because the idea is the moon cracked open. So they're trying to describe something in the sky that looked like a moon cracking open. It's got to be some sort of disaster event. And then you have 1,000,000 dragons pouring forth. Well, it's very common in world mythology to describe comets and meteors that fall, you know, and impact in the atmosphere or on the ground as dragons. The Chinese did it. The South Americans did it. There's some places in Africa where they use that metaphor. It's in Iranian, ancient Persian myth. It's in Native American myth. So it's really basic. They fly through the sky. They breathe fire. They make a big loud sound. They destroy everything. Yeah. So it's easy to see the parallels. But of course, so this is kicking around in my head. And then in the second book, we get the story of Azor Ahai. And this is a story that took place during the Long Night. Supposedly, Azor Ahai was trying to make this sword. And the first time it broke, and he tried to temper it the second time, and it broke. And then he's like, come here, wife. I got to stab you to make this magic sword. And he stabs his wife, and obviously he's working blood magic or something. But it says that Nissa Nissa's cry of anguish and ecstasy left a crack across the face of the moon. So I was like, oh, wait a minute. We've got two different myths where there's something about a moon cracking open. And one of these myths supposedly took place during the Long Night. And that's when I was like, wait a minute. The Long Night is an extended darkness. Okay, it's years go by. You can't see the sun. There's only a couple ways to really achieve that. You know, you can have a nuclear fallout winter, which we don't have because A Song of Ice and Fire isn't sci-fi, and it's not secret sci-fi either. You could have and I'm being snarky, but of course there's those theories.
That was actually, it's funny you mentioned that, because on the original podcast that we ever first talked about Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. one of the things I said is, all this reminds me of nuclear fallout. Maybe this world was destroyed by nuclear bombs, and this is the dragons are a result of genetic blah, blah, blah. I had this whole thing. So I know I'm not the only one, but I know that's a big theory out there.
And it's not a crazy theory at all. Yeah. You can see why people think of it. And other fantasy stories have done that. It's just that that's not what A Song of Ice and Fire is doing when you look at everything. And also when you listen to the words of the author, who basically says, guys, this is fantasy. It's magic. It's not. But in any case, you've got these two legends with a moon cracking open. And one of them's placed during the Long Night. Long story short, you know, there's three ways to have an impact winter effect, where so much smoke and ash and debris gets thrown up into the atmosphere that it blocks out the sun for several years. A nuclear event of sufficient size can do it. A volcanic event of sufficient size can do it. Or a comet or meteor impact of sufficient size can throw so much dust, ash, and debris and soot into the sky that it takes years for it to clear out. And you get a prolonged winter, and it's happened in our history. Scientists are pretty sure it's happened a few times. So that's essentially what I put together, was like, wow, George is telling a story of what happened 10,000 years ago. But of course, it's in the mythology, because the only people that witnessed it had their entire world rocked. All the, you know, whatever kings, you know, were ruling before the Long Night weren't ruling afterwards, because pretty soon you'd have drought and famine and anarchy. Most people would die if the sun didn't shine for more than a few years. You know, all the crops would fail. It'd run out of food. They'd start eating each other. So, I mean, the Long Night is a cultural bottleneck event. And so what George has done is he's hidden the causes of it in the mythology. And in the mythology, we see this stuff about dragons coming from moons that crack open. We've got falling stars in a lot of the myths, including the Dawn myth, and the Bloodstone Emperor worshipped a black meteor, and people are getting fire from the gods from the sky, and Hugor Hill's crown is made of seven stars that somebody pulled down from heaven, and on and on and on. As you delve into the mythology of A Song of Ice and Fire, you see that there's a bunch of astronomy in there. And so that is where the term mythical astronomy comes from. It's basically, astronomy is observing the stars in the heavens, and mankind observed the heavens and then wrote it down in myth, because that is how ancient man stored knowledge, is in the mythology. And that's a real world thing as well. When there was a great celestial event, it would get cataloged in the mythology. And so mythical astronomy.
That is awesome. And you know what, just I really appreciate that explanation. I'm glad we started with that, man, because I see that even in the show too, we had that comet, right? That red comet that comes down that people said, oh, it's foretelling the return of magic or dragons to the land in some way, and the connection there. And you think about in our own lives, the mythologies that have been handed down, even in just the names of things, right? into the way that people have still traditions that have carried thousands of years in our own world. You see those also in the story that we're following in A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones. What's your Game of Thrones journey? Like, when you came up with this, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, but maybe you could tell for those that don't know. Did you start as a book reader, a show person, and then kind of how you got into podcasts, YouTube, and all that? I like to hear.
Well, I started as a book reader, but with an asterisk, because what happened was I read a lot more fantasy when I was younger, and I read it infrequently as a young adult. And I was in a bookshop one time about a year and a half before the series came out, the TV show. And I saw Game of Thrones on there. And I had seen George Martin's books in the bookstore before, but I had just never really picked one up and read the synopsis for whatever reason. And I saw on the front of it, soon to be an HBO television series. And I was like, oh, they're going to make a TV show out of a fantasy novel. That's cool. I better read the novel first so I can see how they fuck it up. So I read Game of Thrones. I loved it. And I tore through all four books that were out at that time. And then A Dance with Dragons came out, and I read that one, you know, right. I think that was out right before the first season. And I'm a book reader first, but the impetus to read the books came from the fact that the show was being made. And so I've always watched the show and been a fan of the show. I'm not a fanboy of the show. Like, I'll criticize it or whatever, but I'm not a show hater either. For the most part, understand that it's a different medium and can't do everything the same and blah, 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 blah. And I think Dan and Dave fail when it comes to keeping characters consistent more than anything else. That's my biggest complaint about the show. Like, Jamie and Cersei's relationship from season to season just really doesn't make sense. Sansa's arc kind of doesn't make sense. They don't really understand what Stannis is about, but you know, the show's enjoyable. I like it. And what I really love about the show is when it brings a scene to life effectively. And like, for example, you don't even have to do it perfectly like the books to do that. Like, the Hardhome attack was not at all from book canon. But it was great because it effectively communicated the feel of a white attack. You know, we know now what the people on the Fist of the First Men felt like when the whites were surrounding them and killing them because of that TV show. It brings it to life in a way that the books just can't. So I really love the show for that reason more than anything else, I think. But you asked about my journey and how I became a podcaster. Well, once I had that theory about the comets and the dragons and all that shit and the long night, I wrote it out in sort of a frenzy over 3 days. Like, I had the brainwave, started writing, and 3 days later, I had this crazy essay that would end up being like the seeds for 10 different essays, but it was all jumbled together and chaotic and stuff. And I started writing on Westeros.org bulletin boards. I was real active there, and that's where I put my theory out at first. And I was writing theories there for a few months, but they were getting too long. And so I was like, well, I better start a blog. Started a blog. And I was like, well, you know, I'm a musician. I've got all this audio equipment. I might as well, you know, make a podcast because people don't have an hour to read my essays. It'd be much easier if I recorded. And I've actually done podcasting a little bit before. I like it. So, I started making a podcast, and pretty soon you have a YouTube channel and you're wearing wigs and stuff. And
where does that come from? You say you're a musician. Do you have a theatrical background? Were your bands theatrical in nature?
No, nothing like that. Ziggy Stardust or Kiss or anything like that. It was more just, I'm just kind of a goofy guy, and my dad raised me on Monty Python and, you know, and the Holy Grail. And I just... You know, the thing is that the material that we're exploring is really heady. Yeah. You know, you're getting into symbolism and mythology and complex metaphors that are recurring through the books and the story within the story and stuff. And so it could easily be very dry and boring or very aloof and detached. And so my natural instinct was to cut it with jokes and sort of just absurd humor and stuff. And that's really just who I am as a person. It's my natural personality is a mix of like really scholarly, nerdy shit and just, you know, Monty Python silliness, mad libbing songs. You know, I've been doing the Weezer songs and a couple of raps for Nimble Dick, and I just love that stupid stuff. You know, it's fun.
I have to tell you, man, I absolutely love it. I totally am on that vibe. And that's why when you hooked up with History of Westeros and Aziz has that sense of humor as well. And just kind of that, the Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire has it too, because in the world, it's so rough and it's so visceral and it's so terrible. Right. I think back, I'm doing my rewatch and I'm up to episode 5, season 6. And when Arya and the Hound happen upon the guys who have cut off, they cut off Rob's head and they put his direwolf on his head. And we all know what they did there. And they're kind of laughing and joking about it. And Arya takes them out. And then there's one guy and she just kind of looks him, stabs him real quick. Wait, was it that, or was it when they meet the guys who she was in the, Yakin Hagar was in the cage with? It might've been that, but anyway, she kills him real quick, a stab right to the heart. The guy dies. And then the Hound just goes, "You're learning," and walks off. And it was one of the funniest moments of the show, but you need a little bit of, I think on podcast, cause I want to ask a little bit about content creation and stuff. I think on podcasts about this show, YouTube stuff, I always appreciate that kind of absurdist humor and adding a little bit something funny to it, because it is heady and it is very complicated and ethereal in a sense. You kind of have to let yourself go, you know what I mean, and follow along down a trail. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And trust the person that's guiding you, because there is sometimes a voice in your head and you're like, yeah, but is this real or whatever? It's like, no, just come on this journey with us. This story is a journey, and the exploration of this story can be a journey as well. But there is also that very visceral, deadly, hard, just like tragedy that's at the heart of so many of the stories in A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones. It's not a very pleasant world.
Yeah, and it's and I don't think it's even just a statement on medieval times and patriarchy and stuff like that. Obviously, it's a little more brutal, but the real world is cruel. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you know how it is when you're on social media. You can only look at so much news about the bad shit that's happening in the world before you just get depressed. People can only process so much. But we all know that there's stuff going on, sweatshop labor and child trafficking and wars that go on for years, and there's juntas that oppress their people, and you know, Western countries are uncomfortably involved in a lot of this stuff. You find out when you start digging into it, and you're like, man, some of my tax dollars maybe went to that. So like, it's a dark world out there, man. And if you want to tell a story, you have to tell the story of like human triumph set against that backdrop. Like,
yeah,
when times are tough, that's when great people rise to the challenge. That's when love and kindness for your fellow man mean the most. And so, you know, like, the good stories usually aren't written about everybody being fat and happy and content and nothing going wrong. So, and Martin does like, and he also wants to be a horror writer. You can really see it come out in certain scenes.
Yes.
You know? So yep. That's just a note that he likes to hit, and he enjoys it. What can you say?
Yeah, that's awesome. That's true, man. So I'd like to ask you, we're entering into this final season, and you've been, how long now have you been doing content creation? A couple of years, right?
Yeah. So I've had my podcast running since mid 2015, and I've had my YouTube channel maybe a year and a half or so, I think.
Okay, like that. Cool. So how do you, when you're coming into this, and we talked a little bit about trailers and I'm abstaining this time, but then when I thought about it, I was like, oh man, if I don't watch the trailer, like In Deep asked me to jump on last week, and I was like, I'd like to, man, but people are going to spoil me on everything that's going to happen. So you have like a kind of there's like, but that never, I just said, nah, I can't do it. I appreciate it though. You know what I mean? Because I kind of always stick to what I'm feeling, not what is going to get a lot of downloads or hits or anything. And for people that do that, that's fine because people are trying to make a living. I don't judge, but it does affect, it clues me into the idea of how, as a content creator, podcaster, YouTuber, watching the show can sometimes be different. You know, like, do you, how do you find it changes your view of this particular television show as maybe you, as opposed to watching other ones? How do you feel about that? Even in the book too, like, do you find yourself reading something and instead of being just kind of caught up in it and taken away, you're like, oh, I should be noting this so I can mention it later. You know, like, we all kind of get into that trap, I think, but I'd like to hear about how you deal with that.
Well, I'm a little bit detached from that because I care about the books by far more than anything else. So my main issues with spoilers, I had to get over a couple of years ago when it was obvious that the show was moving past the books.
Okay.
And I came to terms with that by realizing that they're just very different stories. The way that Martin's going to land the plane is going to be different than the way that HBO does. I'm very interested to compare notes. And I'm really not too worried at this point about the books being spoiled. I think it'll be great. Like, even the things like Hodor, you know, like Hold the Door, like,
yeah,
it's going to be different in the books and it'll be really interesting. And maybe it would have been cooler to have that be completely unexpected, but I'm not really that worried about it. So I don't worry about show spoilers that much. I will say that I never watch videos about leaks. And I was chuckling as you're talking because we all know there are some YouTube channels where all their videos are like season 8 leaks, yeah, leaks. And it's, or huge, huge clue, missing detail and, you know, found. And it's just like, okay, you're obviously just reaching for clicks there. And like you said, people are making a living. If people are entertained, whatever, it's cool. It's not hurting anybody, but yeah, it's you have to follow your muse. You know, you have to do what you're passionate about. That's really the thing. But as far as the leaks go and just the whole TV show thing, yeah, I'm not worried about that because I'm a book person first, and I'm just want to participate in the excitement with everybody. You know, it's the show's happening. It's fun. It's what everyone's fired up about. So I want to be a part of that, and I'll enjoy it. And on my coverage of the show, I'll be talking about mostly the implications for the books. So that's kind of the interesting part for me.
Okay, why don't we? I see that. That's cool. But wait, I want to ask. Do you find, how about when you're reading? How about when new material has come out in the same way that I relate it to the show? Like, as you're watching, you're kind of double thinking.
Oh, okay, sure.
So yeah, when do you find yourself that happening?
Well, so Fire and Blood just came out.
Yeah.
And that was one where there was a time pressure to read it and be able to talk about it, like you said, as quick as possible on live streams or on my own stuff. So I did plow through that one really quickly. I remember the last day I was like pounding out the last few chapters before I was going on to talk about it. So it was a little weird like that. I don't know, when TWoW comes out, I will probably just go into a hole.
Yeah.
And that's what I call the Winds of Winter TWoW. I'll go into a hole and just read the whole thing and then come out, and I'll clear my schedule. I'll take work off and I'm just going to dive into it pretty much round the clock. It's going to be really exciting. Cause I wasn't a content creator when A Dance with Dragons came out. So I've never read a Song of Ice and Fire book, you know, one of the main series books, as a content creator. So it will be different. And to answer another question that you threw out that was interesting, I do watch TV shows much differently now. Absolutely. And movies the same way. I can pick out, you know, the classic archetypes and themes really easily now, where I never used to even think about that stuff. So it does make it more fun to analyze other shows and books, having dove into A Song of Ice and Fire so deeply.
That's really interesting, because you find, like, my journey is I was trained to do that. You know, I started making movies when I was 10 years old.
I fell into this because I realized that dragons were comets, and And I always like, I'm a talker, as you can see. I like to talk and it. I like to write. But this was all, I did not see any of this coming.
I think that's so cool because that kind of proves me wrong in a sense. And I like that because I've talked about before how one of the things that when I listen to podcasts and I watch YouTube, I see people kind of completely ignore the film aspects of a TV show or a film. Like they talk about it like it's a book, you know, and they don't mention things. Oh, well, they had to shoot it that way because, you know, you can tell from the camera coverage or even it dissecting character and stuff like that, how things play out. Uh-huh. So it's interesting to see you come from a book perspective and see that and be able to then dive into it and see that same aspect in TV and kind of learn through your content creation about something and it open up to you and you take it into what you're doing. Because I'm coming from the other aspect where I had to kind of become more of a fan and more of a see how other people see things. Because when I look at it, I do have a problem that I sometimes only see, oh my God, that ADR was terrible. Or when I see like little continuity goofs and I can tell why it happened because in the other camera angle, it's there. And I that's how I break things down because I'm used to going to an event or a location and someone says, where do we put the cameras? And that was my job to tell people where to put the cameras.
So that's more like me when I listen to music. Like I've been a musician for 20 years. I've recorded my own music. I've programmed drums. I know about, you know, balancing a mix and stuff. So when I hear music, I think about all that stuff like, oh, they really overcompressed the guitars on that one. Or, that's a really open snare sounder. But with all this stuff, I was not like, I'm not schooled up on mythology. I didn't even go to college. I had a weird upbringing where like I went to Christian private school and was not even like taught about evolution and shit until I was like 17 and started going to public school. And then I educated myself by reading a bunch of books about science and backfilling all the stuff that I missed. And then I needed to go on a life exploration journey. And so I never even went to college. I don't have a literature degree or anything like that. I've sort of really had to teach myself a lot of stuff through reading. So I love reading. Reading has been my lifeline, and reading is what broke me out of sort of the little mental shell that I was, you know, raised in that I needed to evolve past. But to go back to what you were saying a minute ago, what's really interesting is that, so what you're saying is that you learned a lot about classic filmmaking and stuff. So you understand the idea of a symbolic motif, like, you know, in Cinderella, the glass slipper is a motif, and it's not just going to appear once, it's going to appear multiple places. And by analyzing A Song of Ice and Fire, I've gotten really good at spotting a motif. So for example, to use an obvious one, when Dani is in the House of the Undying and she's getting all these visions and she hears about a blue flower growing from a chink in a great wall of ice, we're supposed to think of blue flowers in Lyanna, connect that to John and realize that this is an RLJ clue. Nice, and the fact that Dani is seeing it is important because Dani's destiny is linked to John. All that is communicated by using that same symbol of a blue flower. And so by analyzing A Song of Ice and Fire, we've all gotten good at spotting those kind of motifs. So now when I watch TV shows, I pick up on those really quick. I'll be like, oh, look, that's, you know, they're using the mirror in this way. And now they're talking about mirrors and that's a theme they're using. And so all that stuff. So here's the thing I wanted to say, Axel, because I wasn't trained on that going in, when I first started peeling apart George's use of symbolism, it really seemed like magic to me. And I was describing it in a way that's like, oh my God, nobody's ever done this before. Look what George is doing. And then as I learned more and more, I realized that a lot of the stuff he's doing is actually very standard stuff that any good writer does. And so I've come to a more complete educational place because of that. However, there are a few things that George does that are unprecedented, or that he's taking a classic technique and then just, I mean, absolutely skull fucking it, if you will. I mean, just like taking it to a whole nother level that nobody has ever done before. And a lot of the symbolic metaphors and the story within a story stuff is where you see that happen.
That's awesome, dude. And your journey is it I mean, it goes to show you. I remember my son was playing basketball with some kids, and their mom asked me, "Hey, what's your plan for college? Does he have to go to college?" And I was like, "Yeah, I want him to go to college." But I say, "But if he starts like taking apart computers or something when he's 15, or if he wants to be a plumber or something like that, that's cool. You know, training and where you get some, we all get to our place in a different way. And as long as we're open along the way and we can take in all sides, you can get there with kind of like a full breadth of knowledge. And I would have, from hearing you talk, I would have thought that you had like a master's degree in mythology and all this kind of stuff, because you're people I talk to who do speak in a similar way. And it just shows you got to just crack open a damn book. Right? Like, people, you know, read a book, people. It's good to do. You can educate yourself. You know, well, you can be your own teacher.
Perhaps if I had a master's degree, I wouldn't say skull fucking so much.
I know, actually, that's the cool one. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because even though I did go to school for film and such, I did not go to film school. And after I left college, I realized, oh, crap, you know, I probably should have went to like NYU film school or something. This is what I really wanted to do. And
yeah, if I had to do it over again, I had the opportunity, I definitely would go to college. And I also don't want to come across as be like, oh, you don't need to go to college.
No, not at all. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I just, to be clear, like I wish I had, and I'm definitely going to encourage my kids to go, especially like the more you move on into the future, it's just like a prerequisite. And I definitely struggled not making enough money because I didn't, and all those things. So full disclosure, I don't want to glorify that, but everyone's path is different. Yeah. I am an unusual kind of dude. I'm also a white male. It must be said, you know, like it's a little easier if you're a white guy to get by, get a good interview or something. If you maybe don't have all the credentials that you should have, you can just talk well. That should be said too, but
speaking well, that is something I used to teach my kids, and I taught high school in Manhattan. And, I used to try to, the principal was always, hey, we got to get them ready for jobs. So I would do like interviews with them, you know, in class.
Yeah,
and I just teach them to speak properly and look in people's eyes. And even if you don't have the right answer, just speak properly and smile and like how these little things, and sometimes culturally are different, you know, can get you in. It's a whole different kind of language, or code switching, as they say, right? These days, that's the kind of
word for absolutely. It.
Like I had to teach the kids to code switch when they were going into those situations.
And I didn't have to learn that because I was raised by a dad who used a lot of big words. And so I credit my father for that. And that's, you know, just something that I picked up on.
So. Yeah, it's awesome, man. We all have our journeys. Yeah, you get somewhere. And what I was saying is I watched a lot of movies, and just like what you're doing, just watching things and talking about them. And that's why I've loved podcasting so much, to be able to just discuss stuff like this with people, books, films, TV. But sometimes it does kind of get in the way when I'm trying to watch something. And I've really been enjoying doing this rewatch and coming into season 8. I have a lot of the same attitude that you do, which is I want to have fun. And there's things I disagree with Dan and Dave. And they were first-time showrunners and then happened upon the largest television show in the history of humanity. And they've done a good job. And as the seasons go on, and as they didn't have the book to rely on, you see a change in kind of as we are talking about our own development, I see the development of Dan and Dave as filmmakers, right? As showrunners, as directors and writers, to what we see now, which is more in season 6, picking up really in 7, and I think we're going to see it a lot in 8, which is the things like distances and time are vastly compressed, and we're getting a little bit more of the checking in vibe. But mm-hmm. I think as our heroes come closer to each other, that is going to resolve itself. And I try to still watch it with an open mind and be taken away. And you mentioned the hold the door. I just watched that last night and I was just entranced, you know, and just the way that you can, the same way you said when you were reading George and you recognize things for the first time that you later came to see other people had done and were standard tropes or formulas, but they were like magic to you. That's how, when you can kind of open yourself up and see with those eyes, you discover so many other things too. You know what I mean? When you kind of, absolutely. Like with a child, you open yourself up to the show and you kind of let go of a little of the cynicism and you let the wonderment of it all kind of wash over you. And that's why I enjoy your theories, man. And when I hear you and when I watch you, I don't always understand everything you're talking about in reference to the show. But what I love is the way that you capture the wonderment, the magic, the beauty, the love that we all share. And it reminds me of Lost a little bit of like, you know, we all created this place together and you're finding something in this story that other people might say like, oh, come on. But I really was very attracted to it. And I think that these ideas are very present in this story. And I think that they tried to get them into the show, but I'm sad that there's not more of that in the show.
Well, first of all, thank you very much. I think all of us content creators are basically people that really liked show and tell a lot in kindergarten, right? That's like, it's basically, oh, look what I found, guys. This is really exciting. And that passion that you're talking about comes from wanting to share something that you find really interesting and lovely and beautiful with somebody else so that we can all appreciate it together. And so sometimes I do feel like an ambassador or an evangelist where I'm on this path where I'm discovering these, you know, symbolic motifs, or in many cases it's more we are, because it's, you know, me and the myth heads, our collective research team that we have, and we'll find stuff and it'll work its way into the podcast and I'll be talking about it. And it's just really exciting. The symbolism is exciting. To me, it's like a pop-up book. Like instead of two-dimensional, it becomes three-dimensional. And instead of just the mountain and the viper having a really cool fight, it's also the sun versus the moon. And there's a celestial layer of cataclysm and apocalypse that layers over what's already a cool scene and just makes it three-dimensional, because now it's working on multiple levels. And that's the case with all of George's best scenes. And so it's basically like a whole level of enjoyment that you can have from the books that it kills me that anybody's enjoying the books and doesn't know about all this stuff. So I'm just like, no, check this out.
I think it's awesome, man.
But as far as the show goes, the show obviously is limited and can't do a lot of the things that the books are doing. But the fact that the books have all this complex mythology and symbolism does sort of create a richer palette for the TV show to paint with. And sometimes those motifs and ideas do get worked into the show, and it enhances, makes the world feel deeper and more complex. And it really adds to the character of A Song of Ice and Fire. Like if George wasn't always describing the moon and the stars in the ways that he does, it just wouldn't feel like A Song of Ice and Fire. Like that's part of it. That's part of the deal.
Yeah, that's cool, man. And I'm all, it's just like, I feel the same way about this as I do about theorizing, or I think that when you can take a material and delve into it and find new things and deconstruct and find parts of it that enliven your passions, go with it. And whether or not a theory proves to be true or not, I don't care. It's the idea of sharing it with people and thinking about it. And it really, the act of that is an act of creation unto itself. And anyone who has ever written something or made something, whether it's a song, a movie, a book, is always pleased that someone even looks at it. let alone has theories and ideas and podcasts and stuff about, you know what I mean? Like, I just think it's absolutely fascinating, man. I love it.
Yeah. When I got a chance to meet George, well, not meet George, but I got to ask him a question at a public speaking event a few months ago. And the first thing I did before I even asked him a question was I thanked him on behalf of us podcasters. And actually Azora Hype was trying to do that before me, but was having mic problems and George didn't hear it. So I piped up and was like, you know, me and the two guys before me are all YouTubers. We talk about your books and we earn money from it. Thank you. You know, so I hope he appreciated that. I hope he got a kick out of it because, I mean, as a writer, yeah, that's what you want. And especially if you're a writer that hides all sorts of mysteries and hidden clues and ideas in there, you want people to figure out that you're actually talking about, you know, Yggdrasil or the Garden of Eden in a given scene. So it's all really exciting stuff. And, you know, you write it as an author. When he first wrote Game of Thrones, he didn't know how popular it would be. And he was putting this hidden stuff in there right from the beginning. I mean, all of my theories are heavily supported by the stuff in the first book or two books, basically. So
taking a little break from our discussion with LML, Lucifer Means Lightbringer, to talk to you about cufflinks.com. Use code ENDGAME30, get 30% off your Marvel order at cufflinks.com. Now listen, some people say, I don't wear cufflinks, but you know what you do wear? You wear socks, you wear belts, you wear pins. They've got all types of awesome stuff over at cufflinks.com, so it may be called cufflinks, but you don't have to be dressing up to wear it. You could just be going out and having fun. And you know what? What else could you have better on than a Hand of the King pin? You can use code DVR20 to get 20% off that. Or maybe you want a Captain America shield. Use code ENDGAME30 and get 30% off that. Go to cufflinks.com/DVR so they know we sent you. Support our great sponsor. Support the show. Now back to this podcast with Lucifer Means Lightbringer, baby, LML.
Can I pick something off of your menu here? You've got a menu.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, do
okay,
it.
So I see one that says, why are the White Walkers coming for Westeros? And there's a related question where you asked, what are examples of mythical astronomy in the show and has it carried over? And so the White Walkers, one of the things I've been exploring lately is the White Walkers' connection to the Weirwoods. So their full name is the White Walkers of the Wood. And George Martin, in an interview just a long time ago, described them as icy she. And when I say the word she, it's spelled S-I-D-H-E. And a lot of people mispronounce it city or something like that, but it's actually she, or the longer term is ice she. And it's from Irish folklore. They're basically, they're the people of the mounds. And so they're kind of like elf spirits, but they're tied to these burial mounds and to the woods and to nature. And they need to be appeased, and they were sort of exiled after they had a fight with the Fomorians and all this other stuff. And there's a lot of parallels to the others, long story short. So when George calls them icy she, he's kind of calling them icy elf spirits who are tied to mounds and trees. And that's exactly what the others essentially are. They are, you know, in the prologue, the famous line is, a shadow emerged from the dark of the wood. And then they describe the others. And so they're sort of sliding out from the trees, and they're walking the woods, like almost as if the weirwood trees grew legs and became angry, icy killers and walked around. And that's the vibe you get. And that's all informed by that Irish mythology that's behind this and the greater idea of elves and wood spirits. So in a lot of ways, the others are kind of like George's version of the Rivendell elves, you know, from Lord of the Rings. Yeah. Like it's the Targaryens have some of that vibe. And the others also have some of that vibe, and they're basically just the icy version of it. So when you in the show, we got a story of the children of the forest, hard pressed by the first men, took this one guy who we've all nicknamed, what's his name? Oh shit, I forgot. We had a stupid nickname for him. Todrick Stark. That's what we call him. Todrick. Yeah, that's Night King. That's Night King. That's his Todrick Stark. That's
he does name. Look like so, a Todd.
Yeah, why not? I don't know how it got started, but we started saying that at Con of Thrones. But in any case, the children of the forest tie Todrick Stark to the Weirwood, and they stab him with the dragon glass, and he becomes Night King. And then obviously it gets out of their control somehow. We haven't gotten the rest of that story, but In the books, I suspect it'll be slightly different, but there will be a level of truth to where the show doesn't even explain why it was a weirwood tree that Toddrick Stark was tied to, where all the emphasis is on the dragonglass.
Yeah, but that's a great point. That is a great point.
I'm hoping that either this season or more likely in the Long Night series that's to come, they're going to get into that backstory of what happened there and develop their ideas of that. But at the core of it is this idea that the White Walkers are some sort of emanation of the Weirwood, and they're pissed off, and they were probably wronged somehow in the past. And all of those vibes and ideas and theories, it comes from the language that George uses, and all of that comes from Irish folklore and stuff like that. And I'd like to give a shout out to Ideas of Ice and Fire, a great YouTube channel. They have a great video about the White Walkers and being Icy She, and he explains the Ice She and what that's all about and stuff. So check out Ideas of Ice and Fire if you have not.
That I really like that. And I think what you're, my understanding, right, is that the, I get confused between Andals and First Men, that someone was cutting down all the weirwood trees, right? And then that was kind of the battle that ensued.
They both did it.
Okay.
Yeah. So the First Men came first. They were cutting down weirwoods. And at some point, they reconciled and there was a pact. Supposedly that happened long before the Long Night. I think that the pact actually happened during the Long Night, and that the reason the First Men adopted, green seer practices and old gods worship is because the children of the forest saved their bacon during the Long Night. But then later the Andals come, and they too begin cutting down weirwoods. And at this point, the First Men ally with the children of the forest to fight against the Andals. And so you get these, it's called the Weirwood Alliance, in fact, in some places, the First Men and the children banding together to fight the Andals. But they basically lost, and almost all the weirwoods were cut down. But then you see the Faith of the Seven sort of come to terms with a little bit of it. And so you have the High Septon carrying a weirwood staff, and you have the Godswood in all the southern castles. If they don't have a weirwood, they at least have a Godswood, and they've got, so it's like there's a little remnant of old gods culture, hiding under there. But to get back to the origin of the White Walkers, I think their origin and why are they coming for Westeros is because they originally, and I'm talking in book lore, they originally were like the original tree spirits or the original green seers. And I think they were kicked out of the weirwoods and they became frozen. And so we should think about them as exiles, people that have been kicked out of their home. And so they are pissed about that. And what they have to do now, and this is my theory, is that they need to freeze over everything so that they can re-inhabit the world. And the Weirwood Net in particular, the realm, the astral plane inside the Weirwoods that we sort of jokingly call the Weirwood Net, Night King wants to freeze that fucker over. And that's why in the show, you see that Weirwood tree freezing over after he kills Bloodraven down in that cave there. Like, that's symbolic of what they're trying to do. They used to live in the Weirwood Net as like regular elf spirits, is my theory. And they got kicked out and frozen. Now they're pissed. They're trying to freeze that bad boy over so they can re-inhabit it, essentially. That's my book theory. And I think the show has a bit of an echo of it. So
I think that's fascinating, man. I think that the idea that they are somehow, and we see this before in mythology and in many sci-fi and fantasy stories where, actually, if people watch Star Trek Discovery right now, they did this a little bit. Do you watch Star Trek Discovery?
Discovery, no. I've watched the Next Gen and the
okay. This is the one. Yeah, this is the one that's on CBS All Access right now, and they have this kind of. I don't want to get into it, but anyway, it's a similar aspect of a spirit. Or a, you could even call it in sci-fi terms, an interdimensional or extra-dimensional being has to inhabit a flesh, a body, and is pissed off about it.
Yeah.
It is somehow thrown out of this one plane or type of existence, which they understand, though it may be foreign to us, and they are similar to the Matrix, when Smith is like, you people, you smell. And, you know, like it's the similar thing. Like the Night King is Agent Smith in that respect.
Right. So look at that show scene where the Children of the Forest have tied Todrick Stark, Night King, to the tree and they've got the dragon glass. Right. So just imagine that when they transform his body, that some part of the tree that he's tied to is inhabiting his body.
Symbiotic.
And that's my theory. Yeah.
Symbiotic. It wasn't.
And that's why they're the White Walkers of the Wood. Oh, and in the books, they're described with all the same language. They're pale as bone, milk white, they're white shadows. And then in Dance with Dragons, we see a weirwood tree getting frozen over called a white shadow or a pale shadow. And it even says armored in ice. It's a pale shadow armored in ice. That's the description of a White Walker, if I ever heard it. So
that is such a great, that is such a great theory and such a great idea.
I
love it because I think that it brings forth all of that ideas that you were talking about, the magical realms and things that perhaps we don't understand, melding with our world and this harsh reality we're talking about. And you can feel how there would be a frustration there. And you can, even in the show, I think you can see that, like, there is a kind of the way that the Night King, like, looks at Jon Snow, or kind of has a plan, or the way they leave their swirling patterns everywhere, which we also find in the actual place where that weirwood was, because I just watched that scene.
Yep.
And you see that again and again at the Feast of the First Men. You see it in the prologue or the opening of the show. We see that the bodies are left in that way. And it kind of melds those worlds, and it brings an understanding to an impetus of why the White Walkers would be, like, pissed off. Like, they actually have a reason to be pissed off. They're not just wanton wanting to take and kill. You know, they're not a senseless murderers. There is a historical and even a spiritual relevance to what they're doing.
Yes, they're very sensible murderers.
Aren't they all?
But so here's a prediction for you for season 8, all right? This is something they could do, all right? They've sort of developed this idea of the God's Eye very loosely in the show, and I'm not sure if they want to use it or not. But you could end up, of course, in the books, we know that the God's Eye is a lake, and in the middle of the lake, there's something called the Isle of Faces, which is filled with weirwood trees. And supposedly when the humans and the first men and the Children of the Forest, rather, made the pact, quote unquote, and started working together, that pact was signed on the Isle of Faces, and all the weirwood trees were given faces. So it's kind of like this hub of weirwood action. And supposedly there's something called the Sacred Order of Green Men on the island, and they maybe have like antlers and green skin and stuff. So it's weirwood capital, if you will. And that's in the books. So maybe the show is going to use that. And what you might get is Night King and his army driving south. The question is, what is he trying to get to? Winterfell? Well, he's probably going to get past Winterfell, it seems like, because the Winterfell battle is supposed to be early on in the season. Sorry if that's a spoiler, but you know, it doesn't seem to be the last battle. So I really think that what you're going to get is the army of Night King trying to get to the Isle of Faces. He wants to freeze all the weirwoods. And if he can freeze the weirwood net central, then he wins and it's game over. And a race against the clock, and very much like Sam and Frodo trying to get the ring to Mount Doom while the armies hold off Sauron's army somewhere else, you're going to get the armies of man trying to stop Night King from reaching the God's Eye, Dany and Jon on their dragons. And this is, they're going to fly north, and they got to get to the Heart of Winter, that White Walker temple, or maybe the frozen weirwood that used to be Blood Ravens. And they got to do some shit up there. So you're going to have this simultaneous journey going on. I think we've gotten a little bit of clues. I know you haven't been watching the trailers, but there are some clues that lead me to think that could be the case.
I think that that's fantastic. And I hope that we do get something like that, because I think they meld in this stuff to be the main point of the show, right? Because right. still the main point of the show, so much of it is who's going to sit on the Iron Throne and Cersei, and you know what I mean? And like mm-hmm. still these shenanigans of we have to get the Karr Starks to join the Umber, you know, like we got to get people to like these political, very human aspects. And we have this layer of magic and history and the land and the White Walkers, of course, who have become, as I'm rewatching, I see how kind of it was after Hardhome, the show takes a dramatic turn towards that is the focus. And we still need to get that. So to have them actually speak these things, right, and know of these things would really make me very happy, because it kind of finally joins the magic and the BBC costume drama that millions of people tuned in to watch on a Sunday night in 2011 and mm-hmm. slowly got sucked into a fantasy story. Yeah. Because I think that's something in this community and being a part of it, I think that's something that I often think people forget about, that the vast majority of people who watch this show, probably 90% of them, thought they were tuning in for a little bit of a magical, kind of cool costume, BBC sword and epic, you know, because there wasn't that much magic in it. And as it increases, that always was a part of the world. And the way that they brought it into the show and the way it was brought in the books, which I don't know as much about, but I've heard that there's also like kind of more of a buildup. I don't know. You may have your own opinions on that. To finally get to this point where that is the point, just like when their point was to go get a white, even though I didn't think that was the best thing. I don't know if that's going to happen in the books. I still kind of liked in a meta way, I liked the fact that a magical element had become the main focus of the plot.
Yeah. You
know, I like that.
And I kind of came down in a similar way, like the idea of going to get the white to show Cersei was like kind of a little bit eye-rolly. Mm-hmm. However, I really did enjoy the journey into the north of our merry band of a dozen heroes.
Yeah, you know, felt D&D, magical. You know?
Yeah, no, like I like
Dungeons
that.
And Dragons, yeah. Not D&D, but not Dan and Dave, but Dungeons and Dragons. Like it finally I felt... Because I'm not a huge, I've said this before, I come from more like a hard sci-fi background, but I read Lord of the Rings. If you're into sci-fi, you get into fantasy. So, but that was the thing that I always liked. I used to play Dungeons and Dragons. I like the idea of getting your team together and going on a mission, you know? And now they're getting the real, like when you talk about these different journeys, that's what I look forward to. Like you have like Arya, the assassin, you know, like Jon, the magical kind of undead warrior, Dany, the dragon queen, Tormund, the kind of, you know, just brutish warrior guy, you know. I kind of like these team ups that they do in the show. And I like that feeling of, that we're okay that we're in a magical world, because I am very okay with that. It's just like, I'm a fan of Westworld. Do you watch Westworld?
I don't know.
Okay. Westworld is like a super heady, hard sci-fi, complicated plot. And I just like being inside of that. And I like that they just throw it open. You know, that's what I said. Like, I like when I first saw you on YouTube and I was like, wow, this guy's just doing it. Like, I like when people just do it. So I like if the show just goes for it and says, look, we're fighting White Walkers. Let's start really talking about the magical stuff and the children and like how this affected our society and like who we are. And I hope that that's a part of this coming season, but I know it's going to be a hope. And before we go, I just want to mention the prequel or the new, I guess we can call it a prequel because it takes place earlier, but it's supposed to be a separate but related world story. you must be really excited about that, because when I get into all this magic stuff and the long night, I just think we're going to see tons of that. And George's has a bigger part, it seems, in this TV series than he did in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I would, you know, I'm trying to keep my excitement for the Long Night series on a low simmer until we know anything about it, really. Like, it could be really cool and it could tap into some of the mythology that I love so much from the series, or it might not at all. So I don't know. We're just going to have to wait and see. If it is at all dealing with some of the myth from the books, I will definitely find a way to cover it and I'll be excited about it. But we'll just have to see. I think everyone's hoping they'll give us something good, you know, to enjoy. So
yeah,
fingers crossed.
Dude, I think that with the changes that are going on at HBO and Time Warner, we are going to see about 15 Game of Thrones series and okay. miniseries.
One of them's going to be good.
Yeah, they are going to do it. And I'm telling you, we're going to have a lot of fun covering them and talking about them. But I was listening to a podcast or someone when someone's like, oh, I can't believe this is almost over. Oh, no. And I'm thinking, this has just begun. Like, are you kidding me? They're going to be making this stuff. Trust me, Disney makes Disney Plus so they can give you every single comic and fill in all the parts between the Marvel movies, and HBO is going to turn HBO Go or HBO itself into right. Game of Thrones Plus, because this right. is what they have.
Right. And they, yeah, no, I, you sure, know. That is the way the industry is going.
Yeah.
So here's what I'm excited to see, Axel. When the series ends, I think we're going to get T-WoW. I'm optimistic that T-WoW's coming probably by the end of the year or sometime really soon like that. I think it's almost done, and I think George is going to be able to put the finishing touches on it, and they can get it to print in like 3 or 4 months, I think, maybe even quicker than that, get it on the shelves. So I think it's coming, and what I want to see is how many of the show watchers and people that have come into Game of Thrones how excited and how involved in the fandom based around the Winds of Winter. And because yeah. like Fire and Blood sold like it was in a Song of Ice and Fire book proper. And let's be honest, the song Fire and Blood is interesting. I mean, it's fun backstory, but it's just backstory. It's not anything close to the level of enjoyment that we're going to get out of the Winds of Winter. So when the Winds of Winter comes out, I mean, I want to see how much it sells. I want to see how many people are into it and how much buzz it generates. I think it could be really huge. It'll be fun to see Martin take the spotlight back a little bit
yes.
From the show. And yeah, so I'm excited to see how that goes. And I'll have a ton to say about Winds of Winter for at least a couple of years after that comes out. So I'm looking at putting out content for a long time. You
That's
know?
Awesome. Yeah, I'm very excited for it. And when this show is over, I plan to properly start at the beginning and read through everything and all the other little stories too. Because
yeah, you better.
I will. Trust me. You're going to hear too many podcasts about it. I think that it's a lot of people are going to be into it. And I think I totally agree with you. Whether it was a plan, whether he's writing it, whether he made a deal with HBO, who knows what the hell happened. It doesn't matter. That's his business. But I like the idea of the book coming out after this show has ended, because I agree with you that the spotlight should be on him and this book. And it shouldn't be all about what the differences are with the TV show, though we're going to talk about that. And that's a fun thing to talk about. But I just think that I just kind of like it when a person gets to, you know, go, like I said, go all out. And I want him to be able to go all out about the book, and he's been working on it. And I know all people have been waiting for it for so long. I'm excited for it. I think it's awesome. And I think it deserves a discussion on its own in reference to the books that have come before it and the story that's told, because it's a vastly different story. It really is. There's so many differences in that I know of, and I haven't even read them all. It texturally, character-wise, event-wise, It's just, you know, it's two different things, and we can love each of them, but the show gets its time and we all get to celebrate it. And then the book can come out and we can celebrate kind of like the whole series and what new things we found in it. I really look forward to it. I don't, you know, we're all in this together. That's what I say.
Yeah. Again, as I mentioned, we're going to be, we're going to be covering the show, this season on my channel, Lucifer Means Lightbringer. We're going to have a pregame show at 3 Eastern and a postgame show right after. And it's going to be me and a bunch of our quote unquote myth heads with a Y, myth heads. And like a Crowfoot's daughter, Melanie Lot 7, Maester Mary, you know, some of the people you see on my channel reoccurring fashion. And we're going to be specifically looking at the show and how it has implications for the last books, because like you said, they are different. They've diverged to the point where they're pretty different, but still the things that happen in the show do give us clues and questions to ask about the books. And that's a really fun, like they're far enough apart where that gap is a fun place to live and speculate and sort of discuss. So that's where we'll be coming at it. And so for you book lovers who are watching the show this season, check out our coverage on Lucifer Means Lightbringer YouTube channel, and maybe that'll be sort of your speed, you know?
Yeah, well, I'll be checking it out, even if I don't understand all of it, because it'll give me some names to remember for later, like all these names that you say that I think sound so cool. That's awesome, man. I like that too. Yeah, it's always fun. They're different. You see them the same. But one thing I did learn too is from listening to book to show and like History of Westeros, especially, I think it was like in season six that I dipped more into that and then went back and listened to, to some other stuff. And you see the way that a lot, they were able to see things that were going to happen. You're right. Things still do happen, though there are large parts cut out. But I think that there's also some fun surprises and theories that are very prevalent to the book that are not to the show and vice versa. And it's fun to look and see why those changes were made. You know what I mean? And you can kind of discover the methodology in telling the story from seeing the changes that were made. And I think that's always a fun thing to do because you get to kind of get a little bit of eye into the creation process on either side of it. And that's
fun. I really enjoy all the good analysis about stuff like that from folks like you or watchers on the wall who you know more about, you know, TV and film and can sort of lend insight into how these choices are made. It really does make it's interesting context for comparing a book to the show. So yeah, I always look out for that kind of good analysis.
That's fun, man. All right, cool. So is there anything else that you want to say or talk about before we go?
Yeah, there's one question I'll hit on the way out here. You said, looking back, and I'm looking at an outline for those listening. We did a very small outline here, more like a menu of questions to pick from. So looking back at the journeys our characters have gone through, which do you find to be the most complete or satisfying? So I'm going to say John and Danny. And the reason why is not because they fall in love, but because Martin, their whole arcs are about learning. That is what I find interesting about John and Danny, is they are forced into leadership too soon. They make mistakes, they pay for those mistakes, and are in the process of continuing to pay for them. But through that comes learning. And that's basically what life is all about, is making mistakes, learning so that you don't keep making the same mistakes your whole life. If you can just avoid doing that, then you'll probably be successful at something. And I feel like John in particular is interesting. You know, his privilege, both male privilege and sort of class privilege, is deconstructed by Mormont and by Ygritte and Donald Noy and the Wildlings and Corrin Halfhand and Mance Rayder and all of it. It's a constant education. That's why the "you know nothing, Jon Snow" refrain is so important, because in order to learn anything, you have to get to that baseline of realizing that you're ignorant and you have a lot to learn. And the shit that you thought you knew was dumb. And that's the place where you start learning. And that's the whole point of "You Know Nothing, Jon Snow." And, you know, Dany's story is a little different because she's sold into slavery And you know, really, she's just, her situation starts off really bad, and she has to suffer through that. And that's why her identity is so strongly tied to liberation of slaves, because she started off as a slave. And so I think that her arc is going to culminate in, you know, we talked about themes. Slavery is a big theme in A Song of Ice and Fire, freedom and slavery. And ultimately, the whites are slaves. They are corpses.
True.
And possibly some part of a captive spirit that cannot rest.
Yeah.
It's not being left in the ground to rest. They're being animated and drug around to do Night King's bidding. And so what is Danny good at? Burning things and freeing slaves. So I find that to be interesting. And I think that's going to make for a satisfying conclusion.
Dude, that is so true. And in rewatching, one of the things I've really enjoyed is seeing John go from what I call a sword bro to being like a leader and a man and a human and a lover too. And the way Ygritte is vital in that, man, she is like vital in changing him. And I don't know whether that's how much in the books that is, but in the show, it was like startling to me that I didn't see it as much, you know, but she really like just lights that fire. And like myself, she's a redhead, so she's got that fire, baby. And it's just wonderful. That's great, man. I think that's awesome. And like John and Danny, we too continue to learn, man. And we talked a lot about this today. This was a great show. Thank you so much for coming on, brother.
Thank you for having me. This was a very fun little session here. And I will be sure to return the favor and get you on my channel one time.
Oh, I would love that. That would be, and maybe you'll get me to dress up. I could put a, you know, I like that, man. I used to be an actor too.
Yeah, it's funny how quick and easy it is for everyone to get into the spirit and wear wigs. I think everyone wants to wear wigs secretly.
They do, man. Come on. Who doesn't want to dress up and have fun? All right. This was awesome. Thank you so much for coming on again. And I'm going to have in the show notes, I'm definitely going to put all the links to you. And please, everyone, subscribe, watch, rate, you know, share, and all that kind of stuff. I appreciate everybody listening today to this show. You can check us out at dvrpodcast.com and podcastwinterfell.com. Email us, podcastwinterfell@gmail.com. I will be back on Monday with my season 6 review. And then we only got a week left. Wow, we are getting close. It's going to be fun. So we're going to enjoy this journey with y'all. Talk to you later. Peace.